This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This month, retired people saw their state pensions rise by just under 5%. That's comfortably above the current inflation rate. How come? The triple lock is how come. A formula set 15 years ago that economists hate, arguing that it's unsustainable and wrong, and that politicians profess to love and are careful to put in their manifestos. It all sounds a bit mad. So what exactly is the triple lock? Can we still afford it? And if not, what's the alternative? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. To discuss this, I'm joined by Carl Emerson, who's a partner at London Economics, Sophie Hale, who's research director at the Resolution Foundation, and Steve Webb, who's a partner at the pensions consultancy LCP. But over 10 years ago, he was an MP, and indeed, he was the pensions minister when the triple lock was introduced. First of all, let's find out how this formula actually works. Carl Emerson, if I can begin with you, can you explain to us exactly what the triple lock is and how it works?
So the triple lock is the mechanism by which the flat rate part of the UK state pension system is increased each year. So the basic state pension, that's available to people who reached a state pension age before 2016. So they're 75 or over today. It increases by the triple lock each year. And the new state pension, which is more generous and available to those who reached a state pension age after 2016. And the way it works is each April, the state pension, that flat rate bit, goes up by the bigger of 2.5. or the growth in prices, otherwise known as inflation, or the growth in average earnings.
Right. 2.5, growth in average earnings and inflation, roughly.
That's right.
And it'll be the bigger of those.
Yeah, and in normal times, you would expect, touch wood, for earnings to be growing faster than either prices or 2.5, and therefore the pension would keep pace with the growth in the wages of the average earner in the economy. But it also means that pensioners are protected when there are downturns. So, for example, if there's an energy shock which increases prices and means that household budgets are squeezed, pensioners don't face that squeeze.
And it also means that if average wages are low, pensioners aren't going to lose out in the same way that wage earners would.
It means, yes, if there's a recession, if wages are growing, but by less than 2.5 or by less than prices, it means the state pension will grow relative to average earnings. It means that pensioners can still afford the same bundle of goods, at least roughly, as they could in the previous year from their state pension. Of course, they may have other income, which is not growing as quickly.
People talk about how this has been having a ratcheting effect. Why should that be?
Well, if you think about what happens when there's an economic downturn, you see the state pension protected from that downturn. So it increases as a share of average earnings because it's growing in line with inflation, which is faster. I think that's a really good feature of the triple lock. You're protecting pensioners from downturns. But then if there's an economic recovery, workers are then getting perhaps compensated for the hard times they've been through. Perhaps they're bouncing back. Perhaps oddly, the state pension then goes up in line with that bounce back. So you're not just protecting pensioners from the downturn, you're also locking that in so that the pension will be permanently higher as a share of average earnings. And it's that what happens in the recovery, which perhaps is a bit more questionable than the fact that we protect pensioners from downturns.
In other words, you use the word ratchet because the effect that has is actually under all circumstances, the pension will go up faster than most other people's earnings.
Yeah, if you had an economy that was just smoothly growing, you would find that, no, the state pension would remain constant as a share of average earnings. But in reality, when you have economic cycles, when you have nasty shocks coming along, gradually over time, the state pension is increasing as a share of earnings, ratcheting up over time.
Right. OK, so what was the basic state pension at the point when the triple lock was introduced?
The triple lock was announced in 2010 when the coalition government came into office. At the time, the basic state pension, the flat rate bit that existed at the time, was £98 per week. Had it increased in line with prices, it would have grown by about 60%. Had it increased in line with average earnings, it would have increased by about 66%. But it's actually gone up by 90% over that period. So the state pension is a lot more generous as a result of the triple lock.
So it was 98 quid then. What's it now?
State pension now is almost twice that amount. It's about £180 a week for those who are over 75 and getting the flat rate component. The new state pension, which Steve Webb, who we'll hear from in a moment, who brought in April 2016, is more generous. That's currently worth just over £240 per week. That's available to those who reach the state pension age after 2016. So that's younger pensioners.
Now, are all recipients of the state pension better off, or are there some anomalies here?
Well, not everybody gets the full state pension, even today. But I think if you spend all of your working life in the UK, you're probably going to qualify for the standard amount. Of course, there are very well-off pensioners, some who earn money, some who've got private pensions. There are also some poor pensioners who fall through the net. There are some, for example, single pensioners living in expensive rented accommodation who might be particularly struggling. So it's always worth remembering that while pensioners on average as a group have done pretty well over this period, there are some much better off pensioners and there are some poorer pensioners.
Although we have the man who brought in the 2016 pension, you just told us, can you explain to us why pre-2016 pensioners are worse off than post-2016 pensioners?
Under the old UK state pension, we had this flat rate component and we also had an additional bit which paid you more if you'd paid more in. So people who'd been higher earners during their lives paid more in tax and got a more generous state pension as a result. What the reform that came in 2016 said is actually we're going to move to a world where people just get a flat rate component regardless of how much they paid in. What it means is in the long run, you'll see people moving on to a flat rate of state pension, the new state pension, the bit that's currently worth £241 a week. And that was made available immediately for new pensioners, not for existing pensioners.
And just one last question while we're on this bit, Carl. Just to be clear, because people are confused about it, the state pension is not actually linked in reality to the contributions you've made during your working life. That's not where it comes from.
That's not where the money comes from. It is the case that paying national insurance is one way in which you can get credits towards receiving a state pension, but there are other ways of getting those credits too, like receiving universal credit. But it's not the case that the money that's paid into the National Insurance Fund is put in a pot somewhere and that's used to pay for the pensioners once you get to pension age. And the reason for that is actually a very good one. After the Second World War, when we introduced the state pension, it was decided that we should pay pensions immediately to those who were pretty close to the pension age, rather than say, no, it's only going to be 16-year-olds who can benefit in full from the state pension.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Now, Steve Webb, you were pensions minister when the triple lock was introduced. How did it come about?
There's quite an interesting history of the policy on the state pension, and the big moment in that was 1980. And in 1980, Mrs. Thatcher famously broke the earnings link. So for a few years prior to 1980, every year the state pension was pegged to the growth in wages.
So it was a single lock.
A single lock, yeah. And Mrs. Thatcher decided that this was unaffordable, and for the next 30 years... it was linked simply to prices, to inflation. And at first glance, what's wrong with that? If it linked to inflation every year, you buy the same basket of goods. So what's the problem? But the problem is that pensions aren't just about avoiding poverty. They're about smoothing our standard of living when our wage stops. So if we have our earnings going on and the pension's falling relative to what people earn, you fall off a cliff when you retire. Your standard of living slumps. And we don't want that. That's not what the pension's there for. So linking the pension to earnings avoids that happening. 30 years of a price link meant the pension had fallen a long way below average wages. So something had to be done. So one option was just to reinstate an earnings link. And most political parties thought something like that should happen. But there were two problems. One is you've done 30 years of damage. So you restoring,
so you've got catching up to do.
Exactly. So you mentioned the ratchet earlier on. The ratchet is the key thing we were trying to achieve, was to rebuild the state pension relative to the average wage. The ratchet isn't an accident. It's a design feature. And so people sometimes say to me, well, the triple lock is, Steve, it's, you know, purists say it's irrational. We can't predict it. We don't know exactly how it's going to work. Well, no. But having a rule, a principle, meant that instead of me having to go and see George Osborne every year, the Chancellor, and say, please, sir, can I have a bit more money for the pension at a time of austerity, we had a rule. And that rule has lasted 15 plus years. People say triple lock's uncertain. Relying on the Chancellor of the day to give you a bit of cash is uncertain as well. So we needed to rebuild. 2.5% was to avoid that politically embarrassing thing. So when Gordon Brown famously gave the pensioners 75p, that was because inflation was 1.1%, the pension was 70 quid or thereabouts. So he gave them 75p. There was absolute uproar. So the next year he just gave them a fiver because there was an election on. Well, that's not great either. That's not rational policy making. So the 2.5% just stops stupidly small increases.
And just take us briefly through the politics of this. How did it get into manifestos? How did it get into policy? Well, and what did the Treasury say?
It's a funny thing. So it was in, if you look back at the manifestos for the 2010 election, it was the Liberal Democrat one. I'm a Lib Dem, I would say that, but you know, it was in the Lib Dem manifesto to say the triple lock. The coalition negotiations, the Lib Dem said to the Conservatives, we'd like this thing out of our manifesto. The Conservatives consulted Treasury civil servants and they said, well, we were going to do an earnings link anyway. That was kind of assumed. So the only extra cost is this 2.5% floor. And frankly, in the world we live in, 2.5% doesn't really matter. So this is almost a free lunch. You can have that. You Conservatives can say to the Lib Dems, you can have something from your manifesto. It won't cost anything and we'll have something else. And that's kind of what happened.
And it wasn't predicted that what has happened would happen back then?
It wasn't, but you have to remember the time horizon of, for example, the coalition was 5 years. So, you can't bind successor governments. So all you are ever doing is setting a policy for 5 years.
Sophie Hale, coming back to today and the impact of all this, how do pensioners compare now with other groups in society in terms of poverty levels?
Looking back in the 90s, pensioners used to have quite a high poverty rate. About 1 in 4 above the pension age were in poverty, and that was higher than for the working age population. So you were more likely to be in poverty after you reach pension age. But since the early noughties, that's actually reversed. So pensioners are actually less likely to be in poverty than working age. And it's even more dramatic when you look at pensioners relative to children, where the poverty rate is about double for children than it is for pensioners in the UK today. So I think there's just a lot of people still kind of look back on that previous trend of an era when we had much, much higher pensioner poverty rates than we do today.
Carl, since the triple lock was introduced, you talked about the 90% increase in the value of the pension. What has actually happened to make that figure occur?
Well, essentially, we've had a period of very weak economic growth. First, the recovery from the financial crisis through the 2010s was much, much weaker than was expected. We then had things like Brexit, we had a COVID pandemic, we had Putin invading Ukraine, all of which have put pressure on living standards in the UK, all of which have meant that economic growth has been really, really disappointing. And actually, you can see that if you look when the triple lock was first announced, the Treasury costing that Steve spoke about, well, they said, well, in 5 years' time, what was expected to be the last year of the coalition government, we think this will cost about £450 million relative to just having earnings indexation. So pretty cheap in the scheme of things. The best estimate is it costs more like £2.9 billion in that year. So it turned out 6 times more expensive than expected, which is what will happen under the triple lock if you have poor economic performance or if you have a volatile economic environment. The triple lock becomes more generous by design in those kinds of periods. And that's exactly what we had.
And actually, we should probably bank the fact that the predictions are that we will have it again.
Going forwards, it does look like the triple lock is going to continue to bind, by which I mean is over the next few years, it's not the case that we're expecting it just to be earnings indexation each year. We do think that occasionally it's going to be the case it will be inflation that will be higher than earnings growth. Difficult for earners, pensioners for good reason, given protection from that.
What happened during COVID?
Well, in the start of the pandemic, of course, a lot of people went to reduce their hours. They were getting furloughed. They might have been getting 80% of their wages. So earnings did really, really badly as measured, as you would expect. And again, for very good reasons, pensioners were protected in the sense that the state pension was price increased in that initial period. And then people came off furlough. And if you came off furlough and you moved from being 80% employed to 100% employed, your earnings went up a lot. So average earnings increased pretty dramatically. And rather sensibly, I think the government at the time decided to suspend the triple lock and say, we're not going to give pensioners that huge increase in growth in pension, which is only reflecting the fact that lots of people are going from working 80% to working 100%. That wouldn't be reasonable. Now, of course, it's really an exaggeration of what you see over economic cycles when workers have a hard time and then they have a recovery. That's what you saw with the furlough scheme by design. Pensioners were protected by that in the initial period, and they weren't fully rewarded for that recovery.
Sophie, in this same period, we've had obviously a significant increase in the welfare budget, so much so that it's becoming quite a major political issue at the moment. What has happened to pension spending relative to other welfare spending? What have been the trade-offs there?
Yeah, so pension spending has increased a lot more. So when we look at the increase in the welfare budget, there's two things that have been primarily driving that: increase in spending on pension and increase in spending on health-related benefits, because we've seen declining health. And what it hasn't been is the kind of base unemployment benefits, where those have been frozen in real terms over the same period the triple lock has been in place, and then linked to inflation. So they have not risen by anywhere near the kind of increase that we've seen in pension over the same period.
Carl, how do we compare with other countries abroad, countries like us?
So it is true that government spending on the state pension in the UK is pretty low by international standards. But I think that you've got to remember that pensions in the UK, because of that, are actually much more reliant on private sources of income. So again, when you think about when the state pension was first introduced after the Second World War, it was a flat rate component. That meant that people often had occupational pensions saved in other forms, saved through private means, and that was supported through tax relief. So I think actually looking at just what comes from the state gives you a bit of a false impression. And if you look in Western Europe, if you look in Scandinavia, you typically see people paying a lot more in terms of social security contributions and getting a lot more in terms of a state pension that's usually related to earnings. So higher earners pay more in tax and get a higher pension as a result. And they have much, much lower need for any private pension income. But I think the comparison of just the state bit is missing the big part of that story.
Steve.
It is funny because as an elected politician, if you talk to voters and tell them that, you know, there's been this largesse to pensioners and they're all fantastically well off, you don't get re-elected. You know, there is a disjunction between the statistics and actually the lived experience. And I suppose for me, the risk is we take a snapshot now and we say, and I don't disagree with any of the facts that have been given, that pensioners on average have done relatively well, partly because we treated working age welfare so shoddily, in my opinion. You know, and we shouldn't use the fact we treated working age welfare so badly as a justification for doing worse things for pensioners. It seems to me those are two separate questions. But the question is, where are we going? And where we're going is a world where people retiring actually won't have access to the traditional gold-plated final salary pension. And if I give you one example, whilst I was minister, we introduced something called automatic enrolment. So you have a job, you have a pension. We now have another 10 million people with something, with a pot of money type pension. But those pots are tiny. So in the coming years, people won't be retiring with traditional big company pensions to top up the state pension. They'll be retiring with tiny little pots. Now, in 15, 20 years' time, it'll be different. But now it's starting to, you know,
it'll be different because those amounts are building up.
Exactly. They've had more years to pay in. So we're in this kind of window, almost, I think of it as a valley. You know, there's the highlands we've come from with gold-plated traditional final salary pensions. There's the future, hopefully sunlit uplands of big fat pot of money pensions. But we're in this window where people will retire with much less private pension than perhaps in the past. So if at just the point people are coming through with reduced private income, we take our foot off the gas on the state pension, then those pensioner poverty numbers start going up again.
Steve, do we have anything to learn? And did you think you had anything to learn from the way in which other countries manage their pension systems?
People often cite Australia as a place where people have built up these huge, what they call super funds, like workplace pensions. The big learning is we should have started a long time ago and built up much quicker. You know, so automatic enrolment was great. It took us 5 or 6 years just to get every company in the land in. We're still only putting 8% in. Most people think we probably need nearly double that. So actually, we've wasted the last 10 years on all of that. We really need to be ramping that up, and we haven't, which is why the state pension still matters. And perhaps we can come back to this point, particularly for women. Because on average, women tend to have much smaller private pensions, but equal state pensions, in the sense that newly retired people today, men and women, get almost identical state pensions. So if we ease off on the gas on the state, which is equal between men and women, and put weight on the bit that's grossly unequal, we're going to hit women more than men.
But Sophie, we must be aware here of this strange kind of dichotomy, which is that by and large, economists, experts and so on say, you can't carry on like this. That this ratchet can't go on. It's taking up a greater proportion of the welfare budget, and it's taking up a greater proportion of what we actually earn as a country. You've got to change the system somehow. And yet, on the other hand, every single political party, just about, maybe not everyone, says that they want to maintain the triple lock. And indeed, I think Reform UK, after a bit of thinking about it, decided they wanted to come down in favour of the triple lock and so on. Why do you think this happens? Why this division?
Well, the reason that it's so popular amongst politicians is basically reflecting that it's so popular amongst the population. So we know that a lot of people support the triple lock. A lot of people support increasing spending on pensions in general. In fact, some research we did shows that even, you know, it's more than half of even young people kind of support higher spending on pensions. So this isn't just about people who are, you know, soon approaching state pension age that support it, although we do think support is higher for those older groups for obvious reasons. And linked to that, those older groups that are more likely to support higher pension spending and to support the triple lock are much more likely to turn out and vote at elections.
I just want to ask you this, Carl. What are the projections going forward if we maintain the triple lock as we have it, let's say 5, 10, 20 years?
So if you look over a five-year period, it tends to be the case we don't expect the triple lock to be very expensive because we don't tend to forecast recessions or other negative shocks that come along. They tend to hit us by surprise. Over the longer term, what's really going to matter is, do we think that the world going forward is going to be like the fantastic period of economic performance we had between the Second World War and the start of the financial crisis, in which case the triple lock would prove pretty cheap and you wouldn't get much of that ratchet effect? Or do we think the world since 2010 is more like what we will experience, in which case pensioners would see the state pension rise faster as a share of average earnings and the price tag would become much more expensive? Now, even in that world, the state pension could be affordable if that's what we want to do. But the reason I get worried, I think, is it comes on top of other pressures that the public finances faces. So the NHS and social care in particular, that's something that older voters will care a lot about. And you'll also note that we're increasing the state pension age to try and keep the cost of the state pension contained. And I think what I worry about there is, well, if you increase the state pension age, a reasonable policy response to people living longer, the people who lose the most are the people with the lowest life expectancies. They might have all of their state pension taken away. Who gains the most from the triple lock? Well, it's people who live to their 90s and beyond who enjoy a generously indexed pension for longer. And on average, they are much richer than those who don't make it to the state pension age.
Sophie.
Well, just looking at the kind of next 5 years in particular, you're right. Obviously, we don't forecast these kind of big recessions and these big volatile spikes. But what we saw after the Russian invasion in Ukraine in 2022 was this inflation shock that meant that the state pension rose by inflation. And then the next year, as earnings kind of caught back up and recovered in real terms, we saw it being linked to earnings. So we saw this kind of 10% and then 9% rises 2 years in a row. And we see ourselves in a very similar situation now. So the next 5 years, we could see quite a big ratcheting effect if we do end up with a big inflation shock next year and then earnings kind of lagging that and recovering in real terms the year after.
Steve, is this what you anticipated?
The triple lock was never forever. There was never a view that this was going to go on, you know, because logically, if you keep going the triple lock, eventually the state pension will be more than the average wage. You know, so logically, there has to be an end point. So for me, the interesting discussion on this is when and how do you switch it off, having done most of the job it was there to do. But I'm immensely proud of the job it did.
Essentially, it has now achieved what it is that you wanted to achieve, which was to get rid of that kind of idea that you always had to be a bit poorer to be a pensioner and to have fallen behind. And that's now gone. And that maybe we don't need to continue with it.
I would say we're more or less where I would want to get to. So for me, the sensible thing to say is, well, what on earth is this thing for? Is there a right level of the pension? Well, you might say that, as Carl said, we've got private pensions and we need to factor them in, but maybe the government should be replacing about a third of what we used to have earnings on average. So say the state pension should be about a third of the average wage, and it depends how you measure it, but we might be slightly short of that. So what you say is, in my view, this is what it's for. This is the level we're trying to get to. We'll use the mechanism we've got, because if we don't, it won't happen. Till we get to this target, we're explicit what the target is, and then we lock it there. That seems to be a rational thing to do.
And are we at the target yet?
We're getting near, I think.
Probably yeah, a few kind more of how years. Near?
Well, we don't know, you know, this is the point. We don't know exactly what the numbers will do. But we're, you know, if we're clear where we're trying to get to and we can say when we've got there, that would be progress.
OK, Sophie, the what can we do question, and then we'll come on to how we sell what it is that we might think we should do. What would you change about the triple lock if you wanted to make it more affordable, more sustainable?
Yeah, so I mean, I actually agree with Steve. The right thing to do is decide what level you want it to be relative to earnings, and then to maintain it at that level. And that means that you link it to earnings in future. What we suggest is that you have something called a smooth earnings link. And ultimately, what that just will allow you to do is to provide protection against inflation shocks kind of in the short run. So when inflation spikes a lot, you would get that inflation and then uprating. But then it would kind of gradually over a few years return you back to the same level relative to earnings and then continue uprating by earnings after that.
Carl, what would you do?
I would do exactly the same smooth earnings link that Sophie's just described. I think the challenge is about how you sell it, how you communicate it. It's the same indexation that they have in Australia for their state pension.
But overall, aren't we disguising the fact that we're trying to reduce the amount we're spending on pensions over what they would be if we continued with the system? So what gives, Carl?
That is true. You are making the system less generous than what it would be under the triple lock. What you're not doing, I think, is making the system less generous to, say, future pensioners relative to today's pensioners. You're saying we will keep all of what the triple lock has delivered since 2010, but what we're not going to do is keep ratcheting it up going forwards. So we're banking all of the ratchets we've had so far. We're just not going to add any more to it.
Now, Steve, we're still going to be saying to people, therefore, as politicians, we will give you less than you would otherwise have got if we hadn't done this. How do you sell it?
Switching it off is difficult by design, but clearly, as we discussed, at some point that has to happen. So the question is, how do you sell it? And I think the least worst way, so if we took the current government, who are still 3 and a bit years away from an election, they could say two things. They could say, we told you in our manifesto we'd keep the triple lock, and today I confirm, Mr. Speaker, that I am keeping it, etc., etc. And I am going further because I have decided that the pension should be a third of the average wage, and we're not quite there. The job is not yet done. So not only are we keeping the triple lock for the entirety of this parliament as promised, I am extending our promise until we reach this target, and then we'll lock it in and make sure that pensioners never again live on less than a third of the average wage.
Carl, how much longer do you think the triple lock has got in its current form? I know it's a crystal ball, but we will have to look into them.
I wouldn't be surprised if, unfortunately, all of the main parties commit to the triple lock in their manifestos for the next parliament. I think then it becomes a question of who forms the next government and whether they keep to the promises in that manifesto. I would be pleasantly surprised if somebody was perhaps brave enough to not commit to the triple lock in their manifesto.
Sophie, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what's been said. We have most parties looking like they're going to commit to it for next parliament, but also a lot of parties promising to cut the welfare bill. And I think they're going to find that increasingly difficult to do in the next parliament if they keep the triple lock in place.
Steve, you've been there, but you're risen above it or beyond it all now. What do you think?
I think one thing that's worth mentioning is that Theresa May tried to get rid of the triple lock in 2017. So the Conservative manifesto for 2017 didn't include it. And she was forced to put it back by the Democratic Unionists who wanted to do a post-election deal. So in fact, there has been an attempt to get rid of it. And one of the smaller parties got it back. So there is a scenario where parties don't include it. But I think if Reform, as you mentioned, who are, you know, ahead in the polls and certainly likely to be a big party next parliament, are promising it, it's incredibly difficult for someone else, unless they put a saving in and say, well, we're not doing triple lock, but we're going to do more hip operations or keep the pension age down or something. But that's quite a complicated message.
And that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Steve Webb, Sophie Hale and Carl Emerson. And my conclusion, it looks like its days could be numbered, but that could be quite a big number. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirsty Knight and Sally Abrahams. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineers were Rod Farker and Dave O'Neill. And the editor was Richard Varden.
Hi there, I'm Izzy Judd, and I'm so pleased to be back with the Music and Meditation Podcast Series 6. We'll be talking about everything from reframing anxiety to getting a good night's sleep. So if you need to find some moments of calm in your day, subscribe to the Music and Meditation Podcast on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.